And now, Rumpole and the Spirit of Christmas.
I realized that Christmas was upon us when I saw a sprig of holly over the list of prisoners hung on the wall of the cells under the Old Bailey. I pulled out a new box of small cigars and found its opening obstructed by a tinseled band on which a scarlet-faced Santa was seen hurrying a sleigh full of carcinoma-packed goodies to the rejoicing world. I lit one as the lethargic screw, with a complexion the colour of faded bronco, regretfully left his doorstep sandwich and mug of sweet tea to unlock the gate. "Good morning, Mr. Rumpole. Come to visit a customer." "Happy Christmas, officer," I said as cheerfully as possible. "Is Mr. Timpson at home?" "Well, I don't believe he slipped down to his little place in the country." Such were the pleasantries that were exchanged between us legal hacks and discontented screws. Jokes that no doubt have changed little since the turnkeys locked the door at Newgate to let in a pessimistic advocate, or the cells under the Colosseum were opened to admit the unwelcome news of the Imperial thumbs down. "My mum wants me home for Christmas." "Which Christmas?" It would have been an unreasonable remark, and I refrained from it. Instead, I said, "All things are possible." As I sat in the interviewing room, an Old Bailey hack of some considerable experience, looking through my brief and inadvertently using my waistcoat as an ashtray, I hoped I wasn't on another loser. I'd had a run of bad luck during that autumn season, and young Edward Timpson was part of that huge South London family whose criminal activities provided such welcome grist to the Rumpole Mill. The charge in the 17-year-old Eddie's case was nothing less than willful murder. "We're in with a chance, though, Mr. Rumpole, ain't we?" Like all his family, young Timpson was a confirmed optimist. And yet, of course, the merest outsider in the Grand National, the 100-to-1 shot is in with a chance. And nothing is more like going round the course at Aintree than living through a murder trial. In this particular case, a fanatical prosecutor named Wrigglesworth, known to me as the Mad Monk, was to represent Beecher's, and Mr. Justice Vosper, a bright but wintry-hearted judge who always felt it his duty to lead for the prosecution, was to play the part of a particularly menacing fence at the canal turn. A chance. Well, yes, of course you've got a chance if they can't establish common purpose, and no one knows which of you bright lads had the weapon. No doubt the time had come for a brief glance at the prosecution case, not an entirely cheering prospect. Eddie, also known as Turpin Timpson, lived in a kind of decaying barracks, a sort of high-rise Lubyanka, known as Keir Hardie Court, somewhere in South London, together with his parents, his various brothers, and his 13-year-old sister, Noreen. This particular branch of the Timpson family lived on the 13th floor. Below them, on the 12th, lived the large clan of the O'Dowds. The war between the Timpsons and the O'Dowds began, it seems, with the casting of the nativity play at the local comprehensive school. Christmas comes earlier each year, and the school show was planned about September. When Bridget O'Dowd was chosen to play the lead in the face of strong competition from Noreen Timpson, an incident occurred comparable in historical importance to the assassination of an obscure Austrian Archduke at Sarajevo. Noreen Timpson announced in the playground that Bridget O'Dowd was a spotty little tart, quite unsuited to play any role of which the most notable characteristic was virginity. Hearing this, Bridget O'Dowd, Kit, Noreen Timpson, behind the anthracite bunkers. Within a few days, war was declared between the Timpson and O'Dowd children, and a present of lit fireworks was posted through the O'Dowd front door. On what is known as the night in question, reinforcements of O'Dowd's and Timpson's arrived in old bangers from a number of South London addresses, and battle was joined on the stone staircase, a bleak terrain of peeling walls scrawled with graffiti, blowing empty Coca-Cola tins and torn newspapers. The weapons seem to have been articles in general domestic use, such as bread knives, carving knives, broom handles, and a heavy screwdriver. At the end of the day, it appeared that the upstairs flat had repelled the invaders, and Kevin O'Dowd lay on the stairs. Having been stabbed with a slender and pointed blade, he was in a condition to become known as the deceased in the case of the Queen against Edward Timpson. I made an application for bail for my client, which was refused, but a speedy trial was ordered. So, even as Bridget O'Dowd was giving her Virgin Mary the Comprehensive, the rest of the family was waiting to give evidence against Eddie Timpson in that home of British drama, number one court at the Old Bailey.
"I never had no cutter, Mr. Rumpole. Straight up, I never had one," the defendant told me in the cells.
He was an appealing-looking lad with soft brown eyes, who had already won the heart of the highly susceptible lady who wrote his social inquiry report. Although the charge is a serious one, this is a young man who might respond well to a period of probation. I could imagine the steely contempt in Mr. Justice Vosper's eyes when he read that. "Well, tell me, Edward, who had?"
"I never seen no cutters or no one. Honest, I didn't. We wasn't none of us tooled up, Mr. Rumpole."
"Come on, Eddie. Someone must have been. They say even young Noreen was brandishing a potato peeler. Not me, honest. What about your sword?" There was one part of the prosecution evidence that I found particularly distasteful. It was agreed that on the previous Sunday morning, Eddie Turpin Timpson had appeared on the stairs of Keir Hardie Court and flourished what appeared to be an antique cavalry sabre at the assembled O'Dowds who were just popping out to mass.
"Me sword I bought at the Portobello? I didn't have that there, honest."
"The prosecution can't introduce evidence about the sword. It was an entirely different occasion." Mr. Barnard, my instructing solicitor, who fancied himself as an infallible lawyer, spoke with a confidence which I couldn't feel. He, after all, wouldn't have to stand up on his hind legs and argue the legal toss with Mr. Justice Vosper. "Rather depends on who's prosecuting us. I mean, if it's some fairly reasonable fellow..." "I think," Mr. Barnard reminded me, shattering my faint optimism and ensuring that we were all in for a very rough Christmas indeed, "I think it's Mr. Wrigglesworth. Will he try to introduce the sword?" I looked at Turpin Timpson with a kind of pity. "If it is the mad monk, he undoubtedly will." When I went into court, Basil Wrigglesworth was standing with his shoulders hunched up round his large red ears, his gown dropped to his elbows, his bony wrists protruding from the sleeves of his frayed jacket, his wig pushed back, and his huge hands joined on his lectern in what seemed to be an attitude of devoted prayer. A lump of cotton wool clung to his chin where he cut himself shaving. Although well into his 60s, he preserved a look of boyish clumsiness. He appeared, as he always did when about to prosecute on a charge carrying a major punishment, radiantly happy. "Ah, Rumpole," he said, lifting his eyes from the police verbals as though they were his breviary. "Are you defending as usual?" Yes, Wrigglesworth. And you're prosecuting as usual? It wasn't much of a riposte, but it was all I could think of at the time. Of course I don't defend. One doesn't like to call witnesses who may not be telling the truth. You must have a few unhappy moments then, calling certain members of the constabulary. I can honestly tell you, Rumpole. His curiously innocent blue eyes looked at me with a sort of pain, as though I'd questioned the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception. I have never called a dishonest policeman. Yours must be a singularly simple faith, Wrigglesworth. As for the detective inspector in this case, counsel for the prosecution went on, I've known Wainwright for years. In fact, this is his last trial before he retires. He could no more invent a verbal against a defendant than fly. Any more on that tack, I thought, and we should soon be debating how many angels could dance on the point of a pin. Look here, Wrigglesworth, that evidence about my client having a sword, it's quite irrelevant, I'm sure you'd agree.
Why is it irrelevant?
Wrigglesworth frowned. Because the murder clearly wasn't done with an antique cavalry sabre. It was done with a small, thin blade.
If he's a man who carries weapons, why isn't that relevant?
A man? Why do you call him a man? He's a child. He's a boy of 17.
Man enough to commit a serious crime.
If he did.
If he didn't, he'd hardly be in the dock.
That's the difference between us, Wrigglesworth, I told him. I believe in the presumption of innocence. You believe in original sin. Look here, old darling. I tried to give the mad monk a smile of friendship and became conscious of the fact that it looked, no doubt, like an ingratiating sneer. Give us a chance. You won't introduce the evidence of the sword, will you?
Why ever not?
Well, I told him, the Timpsons are an industrious family of criminals. They work hard. They never go on strike. If it weren't for people like the Timpsons, you and I would be out of a job.
They sound in great need of prosecution and punishment.
Why shouldn't I tell the jury about your client's sword?
Can you give me one good reason?
Yes, I said as convincingly as possible.
What is it?
He peered at me, I thought, unfairly. Well, after all, I said, doing my best, it is Christmas. It would be idle to pretend that the first day in court went well, although Wrigglesworth restrained himself from mentioning the sword in his opening speech, and told me that he was considering whether or not to call evidence about it the next day. I cross-examined a few members of the Clan O'Dowd on the presence of lethal articles in the hands of the attacking force. The evidence about this varied, and weapons came and went in the hands of the inhabitants of Number 12, as the witnesses were blown hither and thither in the winds of Rumpole's cross-examination. An interested observer from one of the other flats spoke of having seen a machete. Could that terrible weapon have been in the hands of Mr. Kevin O'Dowd, the deceased in this case?
I don't think so.
But can you rule out the possibility?
No, I can't rule it out,
the witness admitted to my temporary delight.
You can never rule out the possibility of anything in this world, Mr. Rumpole, but he doesn't think so. You have your answer.
Mr. Justice Vosper, in a voice like a splintering iceberg, gave me this unwelcome Christmas present. The case wasn't going well, but at least by the end of the first day, the mad monk had kept out all mention of the sword. The next day, he was to call young Bridget O'Dowd, fresh from her triumph in the nativity play.
I say, Rumpole, I'd be so grateful for a little help.
I was in Pomeroy's wine bar, drowning the sorrows of the day in my usual bottle of the cheapest Chateau Fleet Street, made from grapes which, judging from the bouquet, might have been not so much trodden as kicked to death by sturdy peasants in gumboots, when I looked up to see Wrigglesworth, dressed in an old Macintosh, doing business with Jack Pomeroy at the sales counter. When I crossed him, he wasn't buying the jumbo-sized bottle of ginger beer, which I imagine might be his celebratory Christmas tipple, but a tempting and respectably aged bottle of Chateau Pichon-Longueville. What can I do for you, Wrigglesworth? Well, as you know, Rumpole, I live in Croydon. Happiness is given to few of us on this earth, I said piously. And the Anglican Sisters of St. Agnes Croydon are anxious to buy a present for their bishop, Wrigglesworth explained. A dozen bottles for Christmas. They've asked my advice, Rumpole. I know so little of wine. You wouldn't care to try this for me, I mean, if you're not especially busy. I should be hurrying home to dinner. My wife, Hilda, she who must be obeyed, was laying on rissoles and frozen peas, washed down by my last bottle of Pomeroy's extremely ordinary. However, as it's Christmas, I don't mind helping you out, Wrigglesworth. The mad monk was clearly quite unused to wine. As we sampled the claret together, I saw the chance of getting him to commit himself on the vital question of the evidence of the sword, as well as absorbing an unusually decent bottle. After the Pichon Longueville, I was kind enough to help him by sampling a Boyd Cantenac, and then I said, excellent this. But of course the bishop might be a Burgundy man. The nuns might care to invest in a decent Macon. Shall we try a bottle? Wrigglesworth suggested. I'd be grateful for your advice. I'll do my best to help you, my old darling. And while we're on the subject, that ridiculous bit of evidence about young Timpson and the sword. I remember you saying I shouldn't bring that out because it's Christmas. Exactly. Jack Pomeroy had uncorked the Macon, and it was mingling with the claret to produce a feeling of peace and goodwill towards men. Wrigglesworth frowned, as though trying to absorb an obscure point of theology. I don't quite see the relevance of Christmas to the question of your man Timpson threatening his neighbours with a sword. Surely, Wrigglesworth, I knew my prosecutor well. You're of a religious disposition. The mad monk was the product of some bleak northern Catholic boarding school. He lived alone and no doubt wore a hair shirt under his black waistcoat and was vowed to celibacy. The fact that he had his nose deep into a glass of Burgundy at the moment was due to the benign influence of Rumpole. I'm a Christian, yes. Then practice a little Christian tolerance. Tolerance towards evil? Evil? I asked, what do you mean, evil? Couldn't that be your trouble, Rumpole, that you really don't recognize evil when you see it? I suppose, I said, evil might be locking up a 17-year-old during Her Majesty's pleasure, when Her Majesty may very probably forget all about him, banging him up with a couple of hard and violent cases at their own chamber pots for 22 hours a day, so he won't come out till he's a real, genuine, middle-aged murderer. I did hear the Reverend Mother say... Wrigglesworth was gazing vacantly at the empty Macon bottle... that the bishop likes his glass of port. Then, in the spirit of Christmas tolerance, I'll help you to sample some of Pomeroy's light and tawny. A little later, Wrigglesworth held up his port glass in a reverent sort of fashion. You're suggesting, are you, that I should make some special concession in this case because it's Christmas time? Look here, old darling. I absorbed half my glass, relishing the gentle fruitiness and the slight tang of wood. If you spent your whole life in that high-rise hellhole called Keir Hardie Court, if you had no fat prosecutions to occupy your attention, and no prospect of any job at all, if you had no sort of occupation except war with the O'Dowds, my own flat isn't particularly comfortable. I don't know a great deal about your home life, Rumpole, but you don't seem to be in a tearing hurry to experience it. Touché, Ribblesworth, my old darling. I ordered us a couple of refills of Pomeroy's port to further postpone the encounter with she who must be obeyed and her rissoles. But we don't have to fight to the death on the staircase, Wrigglesworth pointed out. We don't have to fight at all, Wrigglesworth. As your client did. As my client may have done. Remember the presumption of innocence. This is rather funny, this is. The prosecutor pulled back his lips to reveal strong, yellowish teeth and laughed appreciatively. You know why your man Timpson is called Turpin? No. I drank port uneasily, fearing an unwelcome revelation. Because he's always fighting with that sword of his. He's called after Dick Turpin, you see, who's always dueling on the television. Do you watch the television, Rumpo? Hardly at all. I watch a great deal of the television, as I'm alone rather a lot. Wrigglesworth referred to the box as though it were a sort of penance, like fasting or flagellation. Detective Inspector Wainwright told me about your client. Rather amusing, I thought it was. He's retiring this Christmas. My client? No. G.I. Wainwright. Do you think we should settle on this port for the bishop? Or would you like to try a glass of something else? Christmas, I told Wrigglesworth severely, as we sampled the Coburn, is not just a material pagan celebration. It's not just an occasion for absorbing superior vintages, old darling. It must be a time when you try to do good. Spiritual good to our enemies. To your client, you mean? And to me. To you, Rumpo. For God's sake, Wrigglesworth. I was conscious of the fact that my appeal was growing desperate. I've had 6 losers in a row down the Old Bailey. Can't I be included in any Christmas spirit that's going around? You mean, at Christmas especially, it is more blessed to give than to receive? I mean exactly that. I was glad that he seemed at last to be following my drift. And you think I might give this case to someone, like a Christmas present? If you care to put it that way, yes. I do not care to put it in exactly that way. He turned his pale blue eyes on me with what I thought was genuine sympathy. But I shall try and do the case of R versus Timpson in the way most appropriate to the greatest feast of the Christian year. It is a time, I quite agree, for the giving of presents. When they finally threw us out of Pomeroy's, and after we'd considered the possibility of buying the bishop brandy in the Cock Tavern, and even beer in the Devereux, I let my instinct, like an aged horse, carried me on to the underground and home to Gloucester Road. And there I discovered the rissoles, like some traces of a vanished civilization, fossilized in the oven. She who must be obeyed was already in bed, feigning sleep. When I climbed in beside her, she opened a hostile eye. "You're drunk, Rumpole," she said. "What on earth have you been doing?" "I've been having a legal discussion," I told her, "on the subject of the admissibility of certain evidence. Vital from my client's point of view. And just for a change, Hilda, I think I've won. Well, you'd better try and get some sleep." Then she added with a sort of satisfaction, "I'm sure you'll be feeling quite terrible in the morning." As with all the grimmer predictions of She Who Must Be Obeyed, this one turned out to be true. I sat in court the next day with the wig feeling like a lead weight on the brain and the stiff collar sawing the neck like a blunt execution. My mouth tasted of matured birdcage, and from a long way off I heard Wrigglesworth say to Bridget O'Dowd, who stood looking particularly saintly and virginal in the witness box, "About a week before this, did you see the defendant Edward Timpson on your staircase flourishing any sort of weapon?" It is no exaggeration to say that I felt deeply shocked and considerably betrayed. After his promise to me, Wrigglesworth had turned his back on the spirit of the great Christmas festival. He came not to bring peace, but a sword. I clambered with some difficulty to my feet. After my forensic efforts of the evening before, I was scarcely in the mood for a legal argument. Mr. Justice Vosper looked up in surprise and greeted me in his usual chilly fashion. "Yes, Mr. Rumpole, do you object to this evidence?" "Of course I object," I wanted to say. "It's inhuman, unnecessary, unmerciful, and likely to lead to my losing another case. Also, it's clearly contrary to a solemn and binding contract entered into after a number of glasses of the bishop's putative port. All I seemed to manage was a strangled yes." "I suppose Mr. Wrigglesworth would say..." Prosper J. was, as ever, anxious to supply any argument that might not yet have occurred to the prosecution, "that it is evidence of system." "System?" I heard my voice faintly and from a long way off. "It may be, I suppose, but the court has a discretion to omit evidence which may be irrelevant and purely prejudicial. I feel sure Mr. Wrigglesworth has considered the matter most carefully, and that he would not lead this evidence unless he considered it entirely relevant." I looked at the mad monk on the seat beside me. He was smiling at me with a mixture of hearty cheerfulness and supreme pity. Oh, I was sinking rapidly, and he had come to administer supreme unction. I made a few ill-chosen remarks to the court, but I was in no condition that morning to enter into a complicated legal argument on the admissibility of evidence. It wasn't long before Bridget O'Dowd had told a deeply disapproving jury all about Eddie Turpin Timpson's sword. "A man," the judge said later in his summing up about young Edward, "clearly prepared to attack with cold steel whenever it suited him." When the trial was over, I called in for refreshment at my favourite watering hole, and there, to my surprise, was my opponent, Wrigglesworth, sharing an expensive-looking bottle with Detective Inspector Wainwright, the officer in charge of the case. I stood at the bar, absorbing a consoling glass of Pomeroy's Ordinary, when the D.I. came up to the bar for cigarettes. He gave me a friendly and maddeningly sympathetic smile.
Sorry about that, sir.
Still, win a few, lose a few, isn't that it? In my case lately, it's been win a few, lose a lot.
You couldn't have this one, sir. You see, Mr. Wrigglesworth had promised it to me.
He what?
Well, I'm retiring, as you know, and Mr. Wrigglesworth promised me faithfully that my last case would be a win. He promised me that, in a manner of speaking, as a Christmas present. Great man is old Mr. Wrigglesworth, sir, for the spirit of Christmas.
I looked across at the mad monk, and a terrible suspicion entered my head. What was all that about a present for the bishop? I searched my memory, and I could find no trace of our having, in fact, bought wine for any sort of cleric. And was Wrigglesworth as inexperienced as he would have had me believe in the art of selecting claret? As I watched him pour and sniff a glass from his superior bottle and hold it critically to the light, a horrible suspicion crossed my mind. Had the whole evening's events been nothing but a deception? A sinister attempt to mobble Rumpole? To present him with such a stupendous hangover that he would stumble in his legal argument? Was it all in aid of D.I. Wainwright's Christmas present? I looked at Wrigglesworth, and it would be no exaggeration to say the mind boggled. He was, of course, perfectly right about me. I just didn't recognize evil when I saw it.